From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on this day in Maine, Monday, December 30th, 2019.
This Day in Maine is made possible by Douglas Ridge, a new eco-conservation subdivision in Brunswick, dedicated to nature-centric sustainable home design. More at douglasridge.com.
A deputy sheriff in Limerick shot and killed a 16-year-old from Massabesic High School Friday night during an armed confrontation. The Maine Attorney General's office confirmed this morning that the teenager, Christopher Camacho, died from a single gunshot wound after York County Deputy Sheriff Robert Carr responded to a report of a burglary at the Dollar General in Limerick. The AG's office is investigating the incident. In a Facebook post, RSU 57 says counselors and staff will be available at Massabesic schools when students return from holiday recess on January 2nd. Southern and western Maine are in the middle of a storm that is moving northeast and will leave up to about 6 inches of snow in York County.
The storm is moving in a northeasterly direction from western Maine into eastern Maine at a very slow pace.
The current storm will end tonight, and National Weather Service meteorologist Todd Foisey says another snowfall will move in tonight to the northeast. Foisey says the second storm will bring a mix of snow, rain, and sleet to the coast and up to 10 inches of snow to northwestern Maine.
Obviously, travel on Tuesday is going to be very hazardous throughout the whole area. In terms of when it tapers off, it's going to be tapering off overnight on Tuesday, and Wednesday is looking quite a bit better.
Foisey says the storm is not unusual for this time of year. In fact, he says northern Maine has been having a snow drought, so this will bring things closer to normal. And after more than six decades in business, Cole Farms Restaurant and Pub in Gray has announced it'll be closing in 2 weeks. In an email posted on the eatery's website, owner Brad Pollard says the restaurant, which his family has owned since it first opened, will be open for its last day on January 13th. He says it has become increasingly difficult in the last few years to continue the longtime success of the restaurant and to weather recent changes. Pollard says perhaps someone with vision and fresh ideas can transform the property into something new that can serve the community for another 68 years. Let's take a look now at the weather. Tonight we will have sleet and snow turning to rain in southern York County. Otherwise snowy overnight with temperatures in the mid-teens to low 30s. Tomorrow, snow in the north. Otherwise snow, sleet, or freezing rain ending during the afternoon in the south. Highs tomorrow in the mid-20s to low 40s. We're looking at accumulations of about 13 inches in the mountains, 6 to 12 in most of the state, 3 to 6 inches along the mid-coast and southern coast, and 2 to 4 down east. And on Wednesday, snow north and mountains with some minor additional accumulation, partly sunny otherwise, breezy with highs in the mid-20s to low 40s. Maine Senator Susan Collins is one of the few members of the Senate to have participated in a trial of a president for removal from office. She spoke with Maine Public Radio's senior political reporter Mal Leary about the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton and why it should serve as the model for the upcoming trial of President Donald Trump.
I think that the model and the precedent established by the trial for President Clinton is one that our leaders should take a hard look at. What happened back then is Senator Trent Lott on the Republican side, Senator Tom Daschle on the Democratic side, negotiated the terms to begin the trial. And those terms were adopted unanimously by the Senate, 100-0. I can't imagine anything like that happening today, regrettably. They decided that we would start with the opening arguments from both sides, and then we proceeded to a period where senators questioned the two sides through the Chief Justice. I remember submitting the only bipartisan question with Senator Russ Feingold at the time. And those questions, of which there were more than 100, elicited a lot of information that was very useful. So I hope we do that approach this time as well. Then we move to what I call the third stage. At that point, we debated whether or not we wanted to hear from witnesses and get additional documents. And there was a roll call vote with Republicans wanting witnesses at that point and Democrats, with few exceptions, not wanting witnesses. So we have a reverse of the current situation. And we decided to call just three witnesses and to have them deposed rather than testifying live.
Should Mr. Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, and John Bolton be people who that should be called to testify, given their firsthand knowledge of this alleged quid pro quo, which the president hates, but that's what it was, on arms for an investigation deal?
I am open to witnesses. I think it's premature to decide who should be called until we see the evidence that is presented and get the answers to the questions that we senators can submit through the Chief Justice to both sides. What I don't understand is why the House, having issued subpoenas to Secretary Pompeo, for example, did not seek to enforce those subpoenas in court and instead rushed to get the articles of impeachment passed before Christmas and yet have not transmitted them to us in the Senate. So that seems an odd way to operate.
You have consistently said you want to be careful in what you say about this because you're in a role of a juror. Given that, you must be sharing the concern of Senator Murkowski that Senator McConnell out there saying we're going to be lockstep with the White House is going to cast some aspersions on this deal, this whole process.
It is inappropriate, in my judgment, for senators on either side of the aisle to prejudge the evidence before they have heard what is presented to us, because each of us will take an oath that I take very seriously, to render impartial justice. That's what it says, impartial justice. And I have heard Democrats like Elizabeth Warren saying that the president should be impeached, found guilty, and removed from office. I've heard the Senate majority leader saying that he's taking his cues from the White House. There are senators on both sides of the aisle who, to me, are not giving the appearance of and the reality of judging this in an impartial way.
What can you do as a single Republican senator to convince Senator McConnell you shouldn't be doing this? You should step back and let the process unfold similarly to the 1999 trial.
I have made that recommendation. I have spoken in our caucus that since I'm one of the few members of the caucus who participated in the 1999 trial, I went back and gathered all the documents. I read the procedure. I went through all of the roll call votes. In fact, I have a very thick notebook that I've compiled with what we did last time, what's gone on with the House, with the transcriptions of those witnesses who were deposed in the House or testified publicly. And I have shared with my colleagues my belief that the Clinton approach, the approach to the Clinton trial, worked well.
Senator Collins, thanks for stopping by our studio.
Thank you, Mal.
And that's Republican Maine Senator Susan Collins speaking with Maine Public senior political reporter Mal Leary. Over the next 3 years, Central Maine Power is proposing to invest nearly $30 million for what it's calling a resiliency program to harden its aging electricity distribution system. Company officials say the network was established long before planners understood the damaging effects of climate change, like windstorms, that cause more frequent and longer outages. But utility regulators and the state's public advocate are skeptical about whether the overhaul is justified. Fred Bever has more.
Here in Elliott's, along a hilly stretch of road near Maine's southern border, line workers and cherry pickers cut away tree limbs that hover above the company's power lines. CMP's leader on the effort is Lloyd Hendricks, the company's manager for process and technology. On a tour of the Elliott job, he's quick to point out the key problem with the system here: age.
These poles right here was identified back at night. They've been up since 1935. Look at this. Look at this one. Look at the difference. Look at that pole compared to the new one.
The older poles are shorter, thinner, and much more weathered than the freshly debarked replacements being installed alongside. And Hendricks points to sections of bare electrical wire that have suffered repeated breaks over the decades, each time plunging the 2,000-plus customers on this circuit into darkness.
Yeah, they cut some of it up. Look at one, two, three, four, five splices just right there.
CMP is taking a multi-pronged approach to strengthening the system here, starting by replacing 132 of these depression-era poles with taller, more robust poles. The company is also upgrading the exposed copper lines to coated tree wire, as it's called, which doesn't part or short out as easily when hit by a tree limb. And the company is installing remote-controlled switching systems as well as redundant circuits that will allow a controller at its Augusta headquarters to isolate a damaged segment, leaving fewer people on the 20-mile circuit without power until a lineman can get to the site to repair the break.
This is one of the worst-performing circuits, which is why it was selected for this resiliency project.
Stan Bakuber is general foreman for a company called Three Phase Line, CMP's contractor on the Elliott upgrades.
Most of the challenges are just the overhanging trees. The fact that it's a windy, busy road here makes it tough. It's a fairly straightforward distribution job.
One thing homeowners in the area might notice, fewer of those overhanging trees. For a decade, CMP has deployed a tree trimming program that aims to cut back hazardous limbs on the entire system. That's provided a minimum of 15 feet of clearance above electricity lines. But under a new ground-to-sky clearance program targeted for now to the company's 12 worst-performing circuits in Maine, CMP would seek property owners' permission when needed to trim trees top to bottom with an 8-foot limb-free zone on either side of the circuit. CMP's Lloyd Hendricks says that neighboring homeowners don't necessarily approve.
On this circuit right here, we had a little pushback, but we're trying to work with the landowners that have to work with them. But moving forward, that's what we want to see, more of that.
So that must be a delicate task.
That is a very delicate. People love their trees. I love trees too, but if it can't prevent me from having an outage, I would do it.
With 70% of outages caused by tree contact in this heavily forested state, more aggressive tree trimming programs are CMP's first line of action. Company Vice President Eric Stiniford says climate change is altering the makeup of the New England canopy, in some cases weakening it, while storm events are becoming more frequent and volatile.
Particularly these fall events where we get heavy rains, saturated ground, we still have leaves on the trees, and we get 50 to 60 mile an hour winds. Predictably, we'll bring trees, uproot trees, break trees off, and that's where we have, you know, our most significant outages. It's happened twice now in the last 2 years.
CMP is proposing $16 million worth of new capital investment in the first year of its resiliency program, with smaller but still significant amounts in following years if state regulators approve them. But some say that CMP, whose shareholders earn a profit on capital investments paid for by customers, is really looking to pad the kind of ongoing reliability investments that any utility must make to protect its infrastructure.
I'm being cynical when I say more robust means more expensive.
Barry Hobbins is the state's public advocate charged with protecting the interests of utility customers. He says his consultants and Public Utilities Commission staff believe that CMP is not following standard accounting practices for justifying its proposed expenditures. One example, CMP is proposing to replace all poles more than 75 years old, whether or not inspections might find they don't all need replacements.
It's great to roll out this program for PR reasons, but it is really shouldn't be looked at solely as a way to spend more money when we the ratepayers don't have it.
Hobbins says CMP should look first to reestablishing its competency with its much maligned customer and billing services. But CMP's Eric Stiniford says that contending with climate-driven costs and deciding who will pay for them will be a growing factor in regulatory decisions.
It's clear that this is now an established trend. Perhaps we didn't see it as a trend as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, but now we feel pretty comfortably that this is the world that we're going to live in for a while, and we need to make adjustments to react to that.
The Elliott project is expected to be finished in a few weeks. After that, the company turns its attention to underperforming circuits in the Jackman area, a project regulators have already approved. The same regulators are expected to act on CMP's latest spending request and weigh in on the merits of its proposed resilience program by the end of January. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And you can find CMP's complete resiliency proposal on our website, mainepublic.org. At the age of 85, Dan Donnell of York decided to try something new. His wife had recently died, and he needed to get out of the house. He started volunteering, and 16 years later, he's learned that not only does he like helping others, he also gets by with a little help from his friends. Patty White has the last profile for our series on Maine centenarians.
If you go to York Hospital on a Monday morning, you'll likely spot Dan Donnell in the lobby. You'll recognize him from his forest green volunteer vest and his dapper attire. On this day, he sports a pink button-down shirt, a matching pink bow tie, and a special name tag.
How do you like my badge?
It says Dan, circa 1918. At age 101, Donnell is still spry enough to escort patients around the hospital, but he admits he's recently had to cut back a little.
Short of breath, and I put a new pacemaker in April, and it didn't do a thing. I'm still puffing, and as I say, I don't know what the problem is, other than old age. I think it's really catching up with me.
As Donnell sits back in a lobby chair to wait for the next patient, he reminisces about his life. He's always lived in York, always on the water. His home is above the marina he owns on the harbor, where he likes to look out a big picture window at the boats that come and go. Just across the way, he can see Stage Neck. Condos are there now, but he remembers a different view.
Stage Neck was originally a place where they dried fish on these racks, and they'd split and salt, cod, pollock, haddock, and they'd pile them skin up in big piles at night. And then the next day, they'd take them all and spread them out so that the flesh was sun side up, so that the sun and wind dried them. They had so many stages over there, that's why they called it Stage Neck. And my dad, I used to take care of the fish that he did at home. At night, he'd pile them up, skin up, and then I'd go out in the morning and turn them all over and spread them out again. And then you do it every night, every day, every night.
Once, Donnell even met Charles Lindbergh and his wife, who were on their honeymoon and tied up their boat at his father's dock. As a young man, Donnell got a job as a rigger at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. It was there that he met his wife, Georgiana, who was tired of working in the potato fields up north.
She came from Aroostook, and she picked 200 barrels of potatoes one day. 2 cents a barrel. 2 cents a barrel.
Donnell courted her by bringing her fresh Macintosh apples. They had 3 kids. While Donnell worked at the shipyard, he also opened his marina. He's owned at least a half dozen boats, but his favorite was his sailboat.
And it handled so doggone well. At least it did for me. I don't know whether it did for anybody else, but I could maneuver that thing, and I got a kick out of it. I really enjoyed it.
He misses that sailboat, and he also misses his wife. She died just a week shy of their 60th anniversary. Though Donnell lives on his own now, a lot of people look after him. His 75-year-old daughter lives just 1 street away.
My daughter does fantastic. I don't know how she keeps up with all the things she pays my bills. He goes shopping back and forth. What do you want? What do you want? What do you need?
His neighbors play cribbage with him every Sunday. They also prepare meals that provide Donnell dinners for most of the week.
Damn crock pot, it's all I can do to lift it. She sent steaks down, spare ribs, mashed potatoes, broccoli, greens. Last night she came down, she had beef too. She'd been making it all day.
The staff at York Hospital are also an important part of Donnell's life. As his shift ends, he heads to the cafeteria to take advantage of one of the perks of being a volunteer, a free meal.
Bye, Dan.
Gonna go eat.
Gotta go eat.
Gotta go eat.
Donnell can't walk down the hallway without being greeted.
Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, good.
When Donnell turned 100, the hospital threw him a birthday party. He says his time spent volunteering has added years to his life.
Volunteer if possible. Volunteer if possible. It'll probably be the best thing you ever do. You know, you get out and you meet people, and you're going to be busy. You got to get up and go to work. You got to get up and go to work. But, boy, if you stay home, you don't meet a soul.
You look fabulous today, Dan.
Thank you.
As always.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Wonderful bunch of people.
For the past week or so, we've been profiling centenarians in Maine as part of a joint project with Downeast Magazine. To read and hear more of their stories, you can visit our website at mainepublic.org/century. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org and join us tomorrow on Maine Calling at 1 o'clock, where we will talk about the decade in Maine news. I'm Nora Flaherty.